Accession number 4586, reel number 2.
Air Commodore Sutcliffe, Reel 2. Could you tell me what your daily routine at Bertram Newton was, please?
Yes. You'd get up about 7 o'clock in the morning. After breakfast, our main first task came was colour hoisting parade, which we had to attend. We formed up by squadrons, the colours were hoisted, and then we'd be dismissed and off to work. Work then consisted of flying. If the weather was fine and suitable for it, we'd go off to our flights. The squadron was divided into three flights. There was A flight. Now remember, this was commanded by Flight Lieutenant G.W. Birkinshaw. B flight was commanded by... Now, who was that? Yes, Flight Lieutenant S.H. Ware. And C flight, in which I was, by Flight Lieutenant Cyril Walter. They were happy days, and we all hit it off with each other pretty well. The flying consisted of cross-country flights, navigation training, the crews, at the end of which we'd probably drop half a dozen practice bombs on our station bombing range. This was the chief means of exercising the crews along cross-country flights and back to base, because that's what their role would be in wartime. On the way, perhaps would be intercepted by the local fighter squadron, if there was one in the area, or by prior arrangement with a fighter squadron some distance away. By that means, we'd exercise our gunners. Radio communication was by Morse, and the man in the back seat was a trained a signaller using Morse. Other duties we had once in a while, once a month about, was orderly officer, and he had again to put on his best uniform. In those days we wore breeches and putties, most awkward things, nobody liked them, and they were changed in about 1935. At the Jubilee, time of the Jubilee Review, King George V. So we had to dress up, and our job was then to inspect the rations to see as they were fiddling. We had to inspect the men's meals, see if the food was cooked properly and was good quality, and to tend to any complaints. We had to take the Jankers parade about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. Jankers was a name used for punishment. Those airmen who were on Jankers, they'd been misbehaving some way or other, and they'd given so many days Jankers. And in the evening, he had to do his rounds of the camp to see if things were secure and there were no problems about. And this used to take place about 10:30 in the evening. He was, of course, on call and used to sleep in a special, the orderly officer's room, where he had a telephone, could be contacted immediately if anything happened. As for the remainder of us, our working day with a break for lunch was flying. We had the odd lectures because we had promotion exams to pass, from pilot officer to flying officer, flying officer to flight lieutenant. And this meant one had to get down to it and do a bit of studying on Air Force life and procedures. I remember we always had to, we had a personal issue of King's Regulations and Air Council Instructions, a great thick book, about 4 inches, 5 inches thick, and we had to keep this amended up to date. If you fell behind in your amendments, then you had about a week's work to catch up. Solid 1 hour every evening or something like that. So it's your advantage you've kept your amendments up to date.
Were there amendments coming in practically every week then?
No, amendments were coming in perhaps once every 2 or 3 months. But they could accumulate if you did nothing about it. And what is more, when it came up to the time of the promotion exam, one thing you had to produce was a fully amended KR and ACI. And of course, they used to ask us questions on the amendments. So that is a thing we had to do. We again had church parades on Sundays. Everybody went to church, except Roman Catholics and Jews. If there's an RC church, they went there, the Jews were reduced, went back to Mass and read the papers. We dined in, I think it was 4 or 5 nights a week, with the exception of Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays. And that meant putting on mess kit and dressing up for dinner. All this, I think, was good for us. It kept us together instead of wandering out separately in the evenings. You all together. There was another factor too, and that was the the marrieds. In those days, you didn't draw marriage allowance until you were the age of 30. So it was a strong deterrent not to get married until you drew the marriage allowance at the age of 30. The result was that most of the young officers were unmarried, and those who were had a pretty thin time of it, because A, they weren't allowed a quarter on the station, had to find one in a local town or village, and B, they didn't draw marriage allowance, so they had a tough time of it. There is a story going of the young officer who was posted out to Iraq at Habaneer, and Habaneer was then surrounded by Wa to keep the tribes out from raiding them, you see, pinching their things. And this young officer was posted to Habaneer. He took his wife there. Well, they couldn't get a quarter, and all the houses, and apart from the officers' messes and sergeants' messes and men's buildings, were for those on the married establishment. So he had his wife out there, but nowhere to put her. So what he did was erect a tent outside the Wa'a in the sand, and he went home every night by climbing the Wa'a.
Do you think it was true?
So he became an air marshal of the Royal Air Force in the end.
So it was a true story?
A true story. But life on the whole was very good there at Birchip Newton, despite of his isolation. Enjoyed it. The senior officers were very friendly to the juniors and looked after their welfare very well. I only stayed there a year because towards the end of 1932 they asked for volunteers for the Fleet Air Arm. And looking at things again, although I didn't find Birchip Newton unattractive, I thought, well, now's the time to get going and see a bit more of the world. So I said, I volunteered, coupled with another friend of mine, two of us volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm.
Before we go on to your Fleet Air Arm days, perhaps I could ask you one or two things about Birchip Newton.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that you would have these exercises in which you were intercepted by fighters.
Mm-hmm.
What type of fighters were there?
There would be Siskins. Armstrong were to the Siskins. Bristol Bulldogs, I think, were just coming in. But they were mainly Siskins, which were single-seater, of course.
Mm-hmm. What degree of success would fighters like the Siskin and the Bulldog have against Fairey 3Fs for interception in those days?
Well, I think pretty good, because their speed range was greatly in excess of ours. And like all fighters, they usually have a height advantage, so they can increase their speed by diving at you from astern. And I think they would have had sort of equal success as they did in World War II.
What type of height could the 3F climb to?
It could go up to about 20,000 feet, I think, where, of course, you'd have to use oxygen. They're equipped with oxygen, so you could use it. But, of course, it is very cold up there. There's no heating. You had a form of electrically heated clothing, which is all right, but it just gets hotter in certain parts than others.
Which parts?
Well, your seat, where the weight was, used to get pretty warm. And then, of course, you'd switch it off because it got too hot. But you'd wear the flying clothing in those days was, for height flying like that, would be what they called a Sitka suit, a leather flying helmet, goggles. And underneath that, you'd have this electrically heated sort of, not underwear, but similar, with wires in it, plug in.
What did the oxygen equipment consist of?
Consisted of a round sort of black bottle about 2 feet long, with pipes leading to various parts of the aeroplane, into which you plugged in a fitting, and then there's a pipe there into your oxygen mask. Your mask over your mouth.
Mm. Was it effective?
Oh yes, it worked very well.
You said that the Siskin and the Bulldog had a good chance of intercepting the Fairey 3F.
I would modify that, because they didn't have radar in those days, and they had to look around the sky for their targets. And provided they sighted their targets, I think they'd have no problems.
You said that 35 Squadron was also Bertram Newton.
Yeah.
Was there much rivalry between the two squadrons? Or?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Competition is a good thing. We're always competing with each other for... you keep the squadron averages, you see. In fact, the competition went right through the whole of the command. Records were kept of the squadron averages as a whole. And that, of course, encouraged the youngsters, the individuals in each squadron, to do their absolutely best to get good results.
Was loyalty primarily towards the squadron, or to the flight?
The squadron is the basic unit of the Air Force, and it still is, even today, and the loyalty is tremendous in each squadron. And the same with an army regiment or naval ship. The loyalty is to the unit. And the unit of the RAF was the squadron, basic fighting unit.
Would you, as a pilot, have your own personal aircraft, which you would use all the time?
Early on, yes. We used to be established in so many crews per aircraft. And we had 13 crews for 12 aircraft, just in case somebody went sick, 13 or 14. So basically, by and large, you did have your own aeroplane. We had, two aeroplanes in reserve, which weren't flown, but kept for replacing those who did crash or had major maintenance problems. So by and large, we had an aeroplane each.
What markings, if any, would... official or unofficial, would your aeroplane have at Bertram Newton?
But we'd have a big 207 across the side of the fuselage, which is a squadron number. It used to be, I think, just after the roundel. 207 and 35, and they have 35 on. We used to have the squadron badges on the fin of the tail. But those are the only markings we really had in the bomber squadrons at Bertram Newton.
Were you allowed to put personal markings on, such as they did in the Second World War?
No, we were not. That was frowned upon, and of course the squadron commander word was law there, and it's not the policy to put on personal emblems.
And that policy was obeyed, was it?
It was obeyed, yeah.
You said that you applied to join the Fleet Air Arm. What reputation did the Fleet Air Arm have in those days?
Well, I think amongst the people in it, they loved it. It was... The Fleet Air Arm came under the Air Ministry. And all the naval, there were 75% of the pilots were naval and 25% were Air Force. So it was a mixture. And all the naval pilots had Air Force commissions. So it did not seem to be unusual, say, Lieutenant Williamson, Flying Officer RAF, in brackets after his name.
And how did the two sides get on with each other, the 75% and the 25%?
We hit it off very well indeed, because I think primarily because when you're on board an aircraft carrier, you're all in one tin box. We're all very close together. And you develop friendships, which you spent more time together than you would have done on an Air Force station when people married, disappeared home, and others went out. There was nowhere you could go but stay in your tin box, play deck hockey on the flight deck, but you're all doing things together. So you got to know people pretty well. And many friendships developed and still remain to this day. And those who served in carriers.
You said that the reputation of the Fleet Air Arm amongst the people who served was very good, but were you implying that outside people didn't have such an opinion?
Well, at the top levels, of course, there are always violent arguments going on as to who should control the Fleet Air Arm. You had Coastal Command, or coastal areas, it's then known at the time. When we disembarked to shore base, that shore base was under the coastal area. If it is in the UK, or perhaps it would be in Malta, it would be under the local command in Malta, RAF command in Malta. Whereas when we got on board ship, we came under directly under the captain of the ship, who had his channel up to the CNC, the Mediterranean, or Atlantic Fleet or Home Fleet, wherever it was. But there were these arguments going up at the top, but they didn't come our way, the arguments. We all hit it off very well together. Operated closely together, you know, in the air, and there was no trouble at all.
What was the competition amongst flying officers to get into the Fleet Air Arm like?
There wasn't much, because it was regarded as, you know, as a press gang being around lately, to press gang people in. And it was regarded throughout the Air Force as sort of press gang job to get people in to Fleet Air Arm.
Why was that?
I don't know. It's a funny thing, but it's possibly due to competition, what have you, between the two services. Not that they regarded us as traitors or to their own service when we went volunteered for it, but the Fleet Air Arm was sort of no man's land to them, but not to us who served in the Fleet Air Arm. That was a great thing. We had a great loyalty to it, and we enjoyed being in it.
Where did you train for the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, when I left Bertram Newton, I went to RAF Gosport, way down the south coast near Portsmouth, and in order to undergo a torpedo training course. This lasted 3 or 4 months. During that time, we flew Blackburn Ripons and Blackburn Darts. The Dart was a funny old aeroplane. It was a single-seater, but it had a cockpit like a bath, enormous thing. The great wheel to control the ailerons and the elevators. Had a Napier Lion engine with a sort of header tank at the top. Looked like a seal with a lump of sugar on its nose flying along. But it's a fascinating aeroplane because you could... its top speed is about 90. Its lowest speed is about 35 knots. So we used to enjoy sort of gliding over Portsdown Hill at Portsmouth. The wind was strong enough you could actually stay stationary in the air. And it was too strong, of course, you could go backwards, which was an amusing sight to watch from the ground. We did used to drop torpedoes from these airplanes in the cylinders, our training, and lectures again. We had to learn all about the insides of torpedoes, how they worked. And at the end of our 3 or 4 months there came the day when we had to do our deck landing, initial deck landings. And this, of course, was a bit very hairy, dicey operation, because they didn't have any dual aircraft, and they used to took us out in a Avro 504N, which is a dual airplane trainer, almost dating from World War I. The instructor in the front seat did a couple of landings to show you how to do it, and then you flew back to your base at Gosport, jumped into your Ripon, and flew back off to the ship and started your initial deck landing with your heart in your mouth all the time. But it wasn't so bad as we feared. Having done the first one, the second one was much easier.
Why was it so frightening at first?
Well, first of all, it's a moving aerodrome, and it's a very narrow one. It's only about, 50, 60 feet wide. There was a lot of turbulence from the smoke from the ship's funnel, hot air. So the thing, as you made your approach, rocking. And it, because of the nose of the Ripon, which is cocked up in the air, it's very difficult to see the deck. So it is altogether a different proposition to landing on an ordinary airfield. And you're coming in not near stalled, but very slow speed, and throttling back at the right minute. Also, it must remember there were no arrestor wires in those days, or no brakes on the wheels of the airplane. So it is just the wind speed over the deck which ground you to a halt, having landed. Occasionally, if you were lucky, a couple of sailors would come out from the wings of the ship and grab your wingtips, help to slow you down. It was all great fun, but a great relief when the first two landings were over and you got back to Gosport. Having done that, that's the end of that course, and I went then out, was posted out to 812 Squadron in Malta. 812 Squadron was a torpedo squadron, again, with the same type of aeroplane, a Ripon, and based, a land based at Halfar in Malta, under the AOC Malta. And when the ship we joined was HMS Glorious, which was part of the Mediterranean fleet. In those days, the Mediterranean fleet, when it's all together, was something really to be seen. There were about four battleships. I don't know how many cruisers, it might have been 10, 40 destroyers. And their chief function was to go around the Mediterranean showing the flag in between whiles, carrying out exercises. And of course, you can imagine when this Balbo, this gaggle's armada, arrived up at places like Nice, or other place on the Mediterranean, the locals had to turn out in force to welcome them, and it was quite a do, with anything up to 10,000 sailors ashore, to keep under control, that sort of thing. So it is a very pleasant life, going around the Mediterranean on these exercises, which you would have three trips a year. The first two were around the Mediterranean, third one would be out in the Atlantic, joining up with the Atlantic fleet and carrying out exercises with them. For that purpose, the meeting place was Gibraltar, and the fleets met. And of course, in the fleet air arm, nearly all of us knew each other, so great were the celebrations of meeting each other again. So by and large, a good life.
Were flying conditions in the Mediterranean much better than those in the UK?
Oh yes, you didn't get the frequency of bad weather. When bad weather came, it probably stayed 2 or 3 days, rather than lasting one day and going. but on the whole, much better weather.
And if you had stormy weather, would there be no flying that day?
It depended on the captain of the ship and his wing commander flying. They used to judge whether the weather was right or whether it was wrong to fly. But if you had a very windy captain, well, he could stop flying when the weather was really all right for flying. But by and large, they got on well together and cooperated, and we flew whenever it was possible to fly. Heavy seas would stop us flying, and bad weather, wind and gales, because the ship, to enable us to take off, the ship always had to be head to wind. Otherwise, you were in danger of swinging into the funnel or going over the other side.
What if there was complete calm?
Well, then, if the complete calm and no wind, that meant the ship really had to steam hard to get the necessary wind speed over the deck to get us off. With the biplanes we were flying then, that was no problem. I think we could all manage to get airborne, and the ship was travelling at her maximum speed. I don't think it's any case of an airplane falling over the front end for lack of wind over the deck.
Did any accidents occur in the Mediterranean?
Oh yes, so many. People going over the side, hitting the funnel, force landing in the sea, or engine failure. I had one such forced landing. It occurred on the 13th of August 1934 when we were taken off for a torpedo attack, 12 aircraft against the battleships of the Mediterranean Fleet. We were about 14,000 feet. And I suddenly saw my plug leads from the engine floating around in front, loose. The plugs had blown out, and that, of course, meant loss of power. The other aircraft, the squadron, just started its dive down to sea level to drop its torpedoes. But in view of the situation, my engine, I said, well, I better stay up top here, which I did. The engine gradually lost power, and obviously I wasn't going to get back to the carrier, so I had to look around for a convenient ship to park in the sea alongside so he could pull us out of the water. We found a destroyer on its own, fired a red Veery light, came down, and the destroyer turned into wind, and we landed in the sea just ahead of him. He pulled us out of the drink. Strange to relate, about 2 months ago, I was reminded of this because in our village of Pluckley in Kent, there lives one Mr. Johnston. He was a CPO in the Navy before the war, and he happened to be in the Bulldog engine room, in command of the engine room, on the very day and time that I landed in the sea in front of the Bulldog. I was pulled out. So that was a remarkable coincidence, which was quite amusing at the time when we first cottoned on to it.
Could I ask you, when you went up in a plane of the Fleet Air Arm, what gear would you be wearing? I'm thinking in particular of the safety precautions that would have to be taken in case you crashed into the sea?
Well, first of all, the aeroplane itself had what they call flotation bags along the fuselage and in the wings, so that if it landed in the sea, it would float for a considerable period of time. And the second thing, and we just wore ordinary flying overalls in the Mediterranean because normally it's hot down below, and on top of that, we wore life-saving jackets, which were green things called May Wests, which we blew up, and they kept us afloat in the sea on our own. We had distress flares, we had dinghies in the Robert Dinghy's in the top plane, which you could, having landed in the sea, you pull a toggle and that would inflate the dinghy, and you climb into the dinghy and sail away. Basically, that is the life-saving equipment on board.
Mm-hmm. Were you happy with this equipment? Did you feel that it was going to be a lifesaver if you did crash?
Oh, yes, we're quite happy with it. The Mediterranean was pretty warm, and so we didn't suffer much from exposure if we came down, provided we were picked up reasonably quickly. No, I'd say we're quite happy with it.
How long would you be able to survive in the water in the Mediterranean?
That I don't know, because I haven't tried it for a length of time. But it depends on the time of year. The water is warm, and depends on sea conditions. For example, in a calm sea in hot weather, the worst thing you probably suffer from is sunburn. But in a rough sea, you get wet and soaked through, and then you start suffering from exposure to the elements.
You mentioned the torpedo practice against warships. Mm. How could that practice take place effectively and safely?
Oh, well, we had our torpedoes, and they'd be loaded on the airplanes in the hangar, hoisted up on the deck. We'd take off our torpedoes. Each torpedo had a number. It had a collapsible head on the front instead of a warhead. And all these torpedoes were set to run in order to hit the ships they were aimed at. So that if your torpedo with your number on came back with a crushed head, you knew it's got a hit. It's as simple as that. So the first thing, all these torpedoes would be recovered after an attack by destroyers and brought in back to the parent ship, the carrier, at a suitable moment, i.e. when they'd gone to a harbour. And then we'd all get around and see who'd scored a hit and who hadn't.